Hello and welcome to the jungles of Club Soderbergh, a podcast on El Capitan, Steven Soderbergh's feature films. I'm Carla Donnelly, your host for today, and I'm joined by my fellow comrades, Jesse Scotch.
Hello.
And Maggie Scotch.
Ciao.
Hola. In discussing the films Che Part 2, Gorilla, and The Girlfriend Experience. It's post the Cuban Revolution, and we are joining the Comandante in the Bolivian jungle as he and his comrades attempt to spread their communist uprising for the final half of Soderbergh's 4.5-hour epic on Che Guevara. If you haven't seen part one, you may want to go back an episode. Our second film is The Girlfriend Experience and is ground zero for minting me as a Soderbergh obsessive. The film stars famous adult actress Sasha Grey as a high-end escort in New York City. It's common Soderbergh ground covering American capitalism and its relationship to sex. This film is precursored by Sex, Lies and Videotape, The Underneath and Full Frontal. It will later be related to Magic Mike and Behind the Candelabra. I feel this film is a perfect encapsulation of the 2008 stock market crash, and in a lot of ways is the other side of the coin to the recently covered bubble. I can't wait to hear what you both think about this film. After 4.5 hours of communist uprising, the two films side by side are interesting viewing indeed. Off to Bolivia we go. Take it away, Jesse.
Estamos en una situación difícil. Y aunque es verdad que todos hemos cometido errores, yo cometí el peor. Por no haber traído mis medicinas. Este tipo de lucha nos da la oportunidad de convertirnos en revolucionarios, el escalón más alto de la especie humana, de convertirnos en hombres en el sentido más puro de la palabra.
Muy viejos para aprender. La rueda, rueda loma abajo. Déjala correr.
Okay, so I'll just translate that quote, which was all in Spanish. Che is sitting around the campfire with his comrades in the jungle or in the scrub, talking to them, and he says, "We are in a difficult situation. The truth is, all of us have made mistakes, but I have made the worst mistake when I didn't bring my medicines along. This struggle gives us the opportunity to become true revolutionaries, the highest level of humanity, to become men in the purest sense of the word." And then it cuts to one of his comrades saying, perhaps as an aside, or perhaps maybe he doesn't even really say it out loud, it's unclear, "Too old to learn. If the wheel goes downhill, let it go." And I think that really gives you a sense of the divergent tone of Che Part 2, Gorilla, from the first movie. Whereas in the Argentine, we see a Cuban struggle bathed in golden light in the warm, fecund jungle that seems to embrace and hide them as they journey through it. In Gorilla, Che battles through a cold, exposed, blue-tinted and somewhat Spartan Bolivian wilderness. The film opens with Che saying goodbye to his family. We see nothing of the intervening years between the films, when Che served in a Castro government, overseeing the execution of several hundred Cubans from behind an administrator's desk. He leaves Cuba unannounced and in disguise and slips into Bolivia to rendezvous with a fledgling group of rebels who hope to replicate the Cuban success under his direction. And at first it seems like they are on a similar track. A shot of him greeting each volunteer individually mirrors similar scenes in Part 1. But from that point on, they are pretty much against the odds. The local peasants neither trust nor welcome this stranger. Revolution weary, they are sceptical of his vision. They inform on him to the military. Several men abandon ship and are tortured and interrogated. Pretty soon, instead of fomenting a groundswelling of revolt, they are diminished on the run and outnumbered at every turn. And this excruciating and inevitable demise is the guts of the film, his death by a thousand cuts, an outcome that perhaps was obvious to almost everyone except Che himself all along. In the first film, we see the transformation of Ernesto Guevara, earnest middle-class doctor, into Che, or Che, fierce and beloved hero of the revolution. In this film, we see how that hardening into an unrelenting belief in the righteousness of his vision and his unwillingness to stop seeking it become both his legend and his undoing. Soderbergh resists the psychological reading of Shay in both films. We never get a whiff of backstory, the usual route to motivation. He becomes through his actions in each moment, and the imprint of them is what we are left with to evaluate his character. Both movies are about actions above all else. But while the first is about the remarkable success in Cuba of a scrappy band of rebels who have unquestionable good and justice on their side, this film is about failure, ill communication, strangeness, and to a degree the difference between commitment and hubris. Now that we've seen both films, what do we think of Che Guevara, or at least Soderbergh's take on him?
Well, it's hard for me to kind of separate out the two because I've, as I said in the last episode, I've never really knew much about Che Guevara until now, so I really only have this view. I don't know, this movie made me really sad. It really made me sad about passion and devotion turning into dogma, and how we can all be the source of our own undoing. I cried when Shay was executed at the end. It just seemed such a brutal, real reality moment.
Such misjudgment.
Yeah.
You know, on his part. This whole episode just seems like a real, like he wanted to, you know, bring the revolution to the heart of America and let it and see it spread, but he just completely misread the situation. And I think the biggest issue is that Bolivia has, you know, quite a few indigenous groups living in it, and Cuba doesn't. It did, but you know, that those, the culture of the indigenous people that lived there were pretty much wiped out. And so I think that this, you know, in a way, the Spanish were the kind of, you know, they could work together and understand each other, but I think in Bolivia that wasn't there. And
they'd also had a revolution 15. They'd also had a revolution 15 years before.
Yeah,
and they were a bit over it.
Yeah.
And also, I found the dichotomy really interesting as well. That it's alluded to in the first film that he had some kind of hang-up about not being Cuban and not being a national, and felt it was inappropriate or, I don't know, uncomfortable about leading Cuban people. But the opposite is true in this, where he is dogmatically trying to force-feed his revolution into a foreign culture, although, you know, experiencing the same, you know, same sorts of oppression as the Cubans and other Southern American people were, just completely tone deaf to
what they're telling him.
Yeah.
Which is essentially, you know, we don't want your money. Yeah. We can't do anything with it. Yeah. Like, and it feels almost like he's more mechanical in this film, in that he's sort of trying to, whereas in Shay 1, it feels like, you know, he's genuinely trying to reach out and communicate and help people. In this film, it's like he's trying to replicate a magic trick, and he doesn't understand why it's not working. I'm doing the same things. Why isn't it working? You know, like, it's sort of this weird, I don't know.
You know, just doggedly persisting. I mean, right at the beginning, Lou Diamond Phillips' character, who is, I can't remember his name,
Mario Monge,
saying, no, we don't want armed struggle, you know. No. And it was that scene was just amazing to me, because he was just standing there awkwardly going, why aren't you listening to me? And they're just sort of, blinkers.
Yeah, this is the way it's going to be.
Yeah.
Whether you like it or not, this is what's good for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you really see Shay's commitment and belief tested here, but not by himself. It's by us as the viewer. You know, we're left to wonder, is he really doing this for the greater good? Which he, you know, he really seems to believe, like, and believe in this vision of a liberated South America. But is it just his own stubbornness or his own sense of destiny or his own pride? And was it just as much about his need to do it as his belief in the vision?
Well, the fact that this film is more linear, you know, this film is more a linear film, like, there's no jumps in time, really, except for the bookends, I think, of the film. And I think that sort of, you know, you are following him through this series of disasters, and that does say a lot about his psychological state, even though it's not, you know.
And that quote at the top is actually, like, very telling, because, you know, he didn't even bring his medicine with him.
Yes,
like how was he supposed to lead when, you know, he could die?
Yeah, there's a certain amount of magical thinking going on.
Where is the revolution without its leader to lead it? And then what would have happened? Mm. All those people would have still been executed.
Mm.
I just found it incredibly heartbreaking and sad because if he wanted to maintain a legacy or continue to work for the liberation of the South American people, surely his outreach could have gone in a multitude of different directions rather than this suicide mission, essentially.
He became a martyr, yes, I think, and I think that was a big part of, you know, like you couldn't get much more martyr than the way he died, really.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting, though. Like, I think it does need to be acknowledged that Guevara is a martyr in some quarters, but he's also loathed by many Cubans because of all those executions that he presided over.
Yeah.
And I think the film completely omits this part of the story, which Soderbergh says was just a practical issue. Like, he couldn't tell every story about Shay. You could make 5 films about Shay and it had to be limited. But I think it's an interesting omission because it's, on one hand, it's a missed opportunity. Like, that could provide some motivation for why he just left, up and left, you know. Maybe he was devastated by that experience. Maybe he was disillusioned. Maybe he was disenchanted. We don't know. And that could have, I don't know, vindicated him in some way or provided some context to the tragedy that followed. But at the same time, you know, maybe it's more interesting to not have that context, for it to be more mysterious and to be left wondering. You know, it's a much more thought-provoking proposition that this same person could be capable of incredible success and incredible failure and for the same reason, essentially, for the same motivation. You know?
And also a comment on what you said in the last episode of Right Place, Right Time.
Mm.
There's many, many, many more incidences of right place, wrong time, or wrong place, wrong time.
Mm.
You know, it's 1% probably is a success of things that just magically work, big scale things. And I think that that's a comment on this, and I think that's why they needed to be bookended in this way, because both films are not complete without the other, which I find amazing, you know, and that they were, I always thought that it was meant to be one film, but they're shot very differently. I mean, obviously they're in different locations, but I felt stylistically they were demarcated quite significantly into two separate films, even though that he did present them as one a couple of times when it first screened. Mm. And I appreciate that more as a bookending rather than one continuous tale. I think it wraps up both messages in a holistic way to have attention against each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. And I think it's really, you know, they mirror each other in that idea that, you know, we're being asked to judge him by his actions, you know, that's all we have. And these two films are saying completely different things about him based on the same actions.
Yeah.
And I think that paradox is what fascinates Steven Soderbergh, you know, about this character that, you know,
Shit men. Shit men with power.
Yeah. I really liked some little touches. I think there was a few more kind of self-conscious touches in this film. Like, there's a scene where sort of 3/4 of the way, it's like, you know, everything's over and it's all going downhill, and you see him reach out for something and he's got this quite expensive watch on, and then you see he's got another one on his other hand, and it's just like a really jarring moment that's not signposted or mentioned. It's just there for a second, and it's like, yeah, the gap between him and the people who he's leading is massive. Yeah. Like, he's not just richer and more privileged, but he's also has this mastery of contemporary life that they don't have access to, and it's just,
well, even in the opening scene with his family when he's saying goodbye to them, the house that they live in, even though they're supposed to be, you know, communist equal country to the people, and it's just very clear that they live in luxury, you know, not luxury, but middle class kind of taste, and there's things around, they've got bikes and toys and that kind of thing. So,
and it makes me wonder if, you know, because he did go from being kind of like this middle class doctor from Argentina, not even from Cuba, if that first experience just completely like traumatized him or something, you know, like the experience of waging war, if that just changed him in some essential way and that he couldn't, you know, exist outside of that context anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's almost like that war paradox that, you know, so many films have been made about where they're just like addicts. And they can't live not on the front lines anymore. And so perhaps that gap is critical in that, you know, he was behind a desk for so long and
but doing horrendous things.
Yeah.
You know, like as a functionary, as a bureaucrat.
Yeah.
So maybe it felt more honest to be doing it hand to hand, you know. This film made me think of Star Wars Rogue One, the prequel film.
Has anyone
seen it?
Yeah, I've seen it.
So, like, that film's all about guerrilla warfare.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, a love letter to unsung heroes of revolutions and about the kind of luck and how much the stars have to align to for this series of things to fall into place to win a war that way. And it's structured around these nobodies of the resistance who one by one have a crucial but partial kind of role to play. But then each of them perishes in the effort. And in this film, it's like the exact opposite of that. It's like in every single instance, nothing aligns or comes together and they all perish anyway, you know, it just made me, I really enjoyed Rogue One, like that conceptual kind of framework of that film. And I feel like Shay is its direct opposite.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, that's a good comparison.
I think there are some more beautiful scenes in this film visually.
Yes.
Like, there's two that really struck me. One was the gorillas walking through the river and you see it from above.
Franklin Pacento has to be called out as well. Run.
Yeah. And that final scene as well where he's shot and suddenly you're in his perspective.
Yeah.
That point of view, that was brutal.
Yeah.
Too much, I thought, a little bit.
It was brutal.
Yeah.
But it was powerful.
Like, it was powerful.
It was the first time you're actually in his body.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was an amazing shift.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, there were some beautiful kind of scenes of, you know, reeds flowing in the water that reminded me of Tarkovsky, you know.
Like, yes.
Or the, you know, the trees kind of rustling and this kind of, you know, just that contrast between, like, this struggle and, like, eternal nature that just goes on regardless of what human, you know, despicable things human beings are doing in it.
All right. I think we'll wrap it up.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes clients think they want the real you, but at the end of the day, they don't. They want what they want you to be. They want you to be something else.
Well,
they don't want you to be
yourself.
Suppose
I'm a rare client that really wants to.
If they wanted you to be yourself, they wouldn't be paying you.
Okay. Similarly, on the theme of money and power and capitalism and excess, our next film is The Girlfriend Experience. And The Girlfriend Experience, or GFE as it's known commercially, is an intimate sex worker service that is meant to mirror that of an actual girlfriend. The bookings are usually overnight, so the client can relax and spend time wining and dining his quote-unquote girlfriend. There is kissing, cuddling and conversation, many of the intimacies enjoyed as part of a partnership and not usually offered by the hour in a regular sex for money service. It is a complex fantasy within which everyone must play their roles. I feel this is the area where Soderbergh is most intrigued. The plain sight denials and pantomime we as humans go through in order to satisfy need. Ego, curiosity, loneliness, rejection, hope for a better future. Money often becomes the side of this in Soderbergh films as it is most often the fastest route to these kinds of satisfactions. But after 4.5 hours of Marxist revolution, this question constantly feels like a thought experiment. Did we start hollow, always looking to fill the void, or were we exploited into thinking we have a void to be filled?
Mm-hmm.
Is this particularly American capitalism or the stain of capitalism generally? The first time I saw this film, the meta-commentary blew my mind. Casting Sasha Gray in the lead role of Chelsea was a deathstroke of genius. Gray, a beautiful young woman who saved all of her money from her fast food jobs as a teenager so she could move to the valley and start shooting porn on the day of her 18th birthday, is a totem of 80s psychologically based patriarchal consumerism culture. but also in casting her, his ever eerily prescient eye also gives Grey legitimacy as an actress and an artist. Grey is smart, eloquent, and proud of her career as an adult star, but is also seemingly deep with unearthed talents. Within a film that is designed to highlight the lengths humans can go to deflect any kind of real feeling, Soderbergh masterfully shows all involved as real people with deep desire. Chelsea believes in the personology system that is based around birthday compatibility and uses it in her working life to determine which clients she should see. Most of her clients complain about the stock market crash and its damage to their businesses. All are committed to abstract methodologies of being in the world. Chelsea's live-in boyfriend Chris is loving and loyal and supportive of her work, and yet it's not until a client really wants to know her as a person does she throw everything away to pursue this relationship. House of Cards crumble, hindsight is 2020. I'm curious to know how this film made you feel. Did you feel this is a decidedly modern conundrum for the social media generation? Or do you think most people are disconnected from their true feelings and are shallowly continuing to swipe right on life?
Second option.
So harsh.
I think this film was brilliant. Because it really is so non-linear.
Mm-hmm.
In a very complex way, and the editing is just brilliant. The sound, everything, it just, all his skill is just completely successful here. It's, you know, really, you just, what you don't know quite what's going on. It's just a sort of quite a jumble of
and sound. Each scene can stand alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, I think it's incredible, definitely worth watching. The way, I don't know, like, I think the stock market stuff maybe affected me more than her stuff, like her life as an escort. That stuff didn't really interest me as much as, you know, the guys talking about the junket. There is a business junket.
A literal junket, yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely funnier than I remember it being. Like, it's, you know, there's lots of ironic interactions, like, between her and stupid rich men hoisting themselves on their own petard, kind of revealing themselves to be the dickheads that they are, you know, unwittingly, which I found really entertaining.
Yeah, and she's quite sort of
blank.
She doesn't give anything away.
I think that there's definitely a commentary on the GFC. It's quite explicit, but I also feel like it's kind of about the moment before that, when capital started to structure all of our interactions in the 2000s, and this idea that the clear exchange of money for services like legitimizes or at least neutralizes activities and interactions that were once illicit. And the, you know, like, there's that disgusting escort reviewer who says, sounds like a white slavery ring, but it's not.
Yeah.
Like, he's so disgusting and such an obvious slime ball, but he feels totally confident and affirmed in speaking this way about something that would be associated with criminal activity and degradation, you know, in the very recent past. So I feel like in this particular moment in time, everyone just became a small business owner. You know, like, and that's a really interesting moment that this film describes. And I think it also speaks to the pop cultural moment where it became totally legitimate to parlay any form of notoriety into some kind of celebrity and then into some kind of commercial outcome. So,
but do you think, back to my question, do you think that is a more centrally American issue? Yeah.
Okay. I think it's about American culture. Yeah. Like, in that moment in American culture when that started happening. And I think it's related to, like, you know, it's the era that produced Kim Kardashian and Paris Hilton and all those reality TV stars who would have spin-off businesses, you know, like, these people constantly churning through the machine.
Yeah, it was like a year after Paris Hilton kind of thing. Yeah,
exactly. And I feel like that, you know, like, her story kind of mirrors that, you know, mirrors Grey's own story, which, you know, she kind of strategically entered the porn industry at this really young age as a way to enter into other fields that she wanted to pursue. Whereas in the past, a porn background would be a huge black mark against you, and it'd be something you'd have to hide, or it would stay in your career in some way. But in this era, suddenly it's all equal. It's all just fodder. You know, like, there's no, and
but it's also something that young girls are aspiring to do, and as I said in my intro, saving their fast food money
yeah.
so that they can start their porn career the day that they're legal, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that that describes, yeah, like I think that that, I don't think that was a result of the stock market crash. I think no. that was happening before mm. the stock market crash. And I think that, you know, the film kind of talks about both.
Well, I think the stock market crash is ultimately a result of that level of
yeah.
social degradation
yeah.
and greed.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. If you can't yeah. tell, I've become a card-carrying Marxist from the last series of films that we've watched.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I think that, you know, it's an era where we started accepting that, like, you know, if you can accept this kind of exploitation of, say, like, the film industry's general mm. kind of, you know, like, garden variety exploitation, then any other form of exploitation is just on a spectrum with that, you know? Like, it's yes. all kind of... I don't know, it's just...
sale.
Yeah,
it's the same exactly. thing I feel about, you know, commercial surrogacy, you know, right. which is a specific American thing that is available because it is banned and outlawed in almost every country. Mm. I think Soderbergh, my feelings about this film are summed up with also, like, his, you know, non-actors, employing non-actors, and he was asked about, you know, that. And he said, with Sasha, you can within seconds see her do anything you can imagine with her clothes off. What you can't see is what it's like to be her boyfriend, to hang out with her mm. and be emotionally intimate with her. So my whole theory is that's the fantasy for those who've been double-clicking, that they want to spend 77 minutes being her boyfriend.
Right.
Which I think is very sweet, but probably not true. I'm not sure.
Well,
but in a way that we desire what we can't have, yes.
Or we desire a fantasy of it. It's not, we don't actually yes. really want, you know, she says that herself, like they want yeah, me to be what they want me top. To be. Yeah. yeah. And, you know, like there are obviously lots of reasons why women might go into porn or into sex work, but they're substantially different from other forms of service provision.
Mm.
They engage human intimacy, they capitalize it. And I think that he, you know, in this film, he's really exploring not so much making a social judgment like at large, but like exploring how that might affect, like you say, like how a couple interact with each other, how that, you know, affects their intimacy as a, in a long-term committed relationship, how, you know, yeah, like all the kind of personal impacts of that, mm. which I thought was...
And it's like he's been exploring that. Like I'm thinking about the underneath as you guys are talking and the mm. relationship between... what's his name?
It is a very spiritually side-by-side with the underneath.
I think so, yeah. And where that kind of failed, this really succeeds. Or it's mm. like, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be that, but he's definitely expanded on that at a time when he can illustrate these points much more clearly. It's not about addiction necessarily, but...
Well, and interestingly enough, it was shot in October 2008, which was a month before Obama was elected
mm.
and just after the stock market crash.
Mm.
And a lot of this was not scripted.
Right.
So mm-hmm. these improvisations are these people's obsessions.
Talking about what's happening
yeah,
at the time.
It's totally zeitgeist, which was unintentional, but he's like, it totally fucking worked out for me. Like,
Yeah. It's really funny. There's a scene where, like, she's flipping through a newspaper and I was like, that dates the film. Because, you know, it's like, oh, all it's the headlines of the day. Yeah. It's like a physical newspaper.
Yeah,
that's really funny. People still read newspapers.
I think this film is absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
I have a question for you guys. Mm. Like, so she, you know, towards the end of the film, she decides to, you know, potentially trash her relationship, quite sanguinely decides to trash her relationship with her very supportive partner because she has a personology, you know, connection to this client who wants to take her away for the weekend. So my question is, do you think that she falls for the client as an escape, like falling into the trap of this kind of magical thinking against this background of highly rationalized thinking about her life and choices, you know, highly monetized and rationalized? Or is it just an extension of these transactionalized arrangements that her current relationship is just like another transaction that can be weighed against others, mm. another thing that can be, you know, like bought or sold, like discarded. Yeah. Like, is it really unreadable to me, like what mm. her...
I don't know. I think she's only human and that, you know, if you're living out, you know, surely, I mean, maybe that's what it's about. Surely if you're living out, you know, these fantasies as a, you know, it is hard to separate those things, I'm sure. I don't know, but maybe that's what, you know, she's only human and she's kind of believing in her own work, the fantasy of her own work. But I'm not sure. What do you think, Carla?
I actually think it's both.
Yeah, right.
So I think that, as do we all, come to take our partners for granted, or the see roles that they have as transactional, like the scene where he's comforting her from having a bad day at work, you know, regardless of the content of what her bad day of work was. I think we as people do that, more to Maggie's point. But then also I think that she is a fantasy and is quite obviously comfortable in that, with these clients, but has that horrible interaction with the, what is it, the erotic connoisseur or the escort connoisseur or whatever he's called, and goes straight to a client meeting after him, and he's someone who is genuinely interested in her and wants to show compassion.
Yeah.
And I think that that is so intoxicating to her that she until she actually had it, she never knew that she wanted it. And that was the moment of her unraveling. And I would hazard a guess that she probably wouldn't have really been able to go back to sex work the same again or in any way after that. So I think it's both.
What did you think of the aesthetic of the film, like the video shot on red?
I loved it. I thought it was really clinical.
Yeah.
Which was appropriate.
I agree, yeah.
Yeah, I loved it too.
I thought it was great. Beautiful, but it was totally de-glamorized.
I didn't look up who actually edited this film.
I assume it was Soderbergh, but I don't know.
Yeah, because we're at this point where he just pretty much all does his does everything. Principal photography on every film.
Yeah.
Not sure about editing. I think I'm pretty sure he did it because he made this film for $1.3 million.
Yeah.
With a crew of 12 people.
Yeah. It did remind me a bit of the editing in The Limey.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, there's a lot, I just feel like there's a lot of shots that move like this and then cut, and you know, it's just got a real kind of going past the windows of a train moving or something. Like, it's kind of got that feel to it,
and the kind of elliptical, you know, like moving through time.
Yeah,
you know.
But this one I could put together. Like, you're given only 10 puzzle pieces
for this.
Yeah, you can kind of like, not that it even really mattered, which I think was incredible as well, you know.
Yeah. I think it's quite an achievement that it never feels kind of pervy or, you know, excessively male-gazy. Like, and I think that's kind of made me think about that, like, there's very rarely sex or nudity in Soderbergh films.
Yeah.
Like, he's interested in these things, but he doesn't...
quite prude.
He's not, I don't know if he's a prude or if he feels like, you know, if I show it, it's like too easy or something. Yeah. Like, I imagine that's kind of...
Well, it probably is.
Yeah.
To be perfectly honest. Where is it really necessary?
Yeah, that's right.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that was kind of interesting that, you know, like sometimes there's sexism in his films, but there's never that, like, gratuitousness or exploitative.
Well, apart from Ellen Barkin in Ocean 13. But
we just failed to talk about that because it was so disturbing.
It was just terrible. It was so terrible. Let's talk about that in press pause, actually. Are we ready for that? Yeah, yes. Okay.
Press pause.
All right, do we want to go back and revisit Ellen Barkin? Because I love this idea that she's like some kind of cougar and, you know, would find young Matt Damon irresistibly attractive.
Oh, my God.
So why did he need the pheromone patch? I mean, I know I'm nitpicking at logic holes in this movie, but, you know.
It was so I blocked
weird.
It from my memory. I'm just like...
as a character thing, you know, we were talking about... I can't believe we're going back to another episode, but... that character, you know, he's like, me, I want to seduce her. You know, I've made inroads. And everyone's gross. Like, okay, you know, have a go.
Your name is Linus.
Yeah.
No one wants to fuck you.
But then he's all weird and prudish when, you know, when it's happening, even though he's basically date raping her.
Oh, my God. You know, I know. Essentially, weird. Like, he's drugged her, essentially.
Yeah.
Horrible.
Ugh. I've got some stuff about Shay... 2, which is also kind of about Shay 1. Like, it's a little hard to separate them.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But I thought it was interesting that they actually started with Shay 2. Like, that was the first film they were going to make, and then they decided, you know, after doing all the research, that they had to have the context of... So it's sort of for hard to imagine that film on its own. Like, they really are so together.
Yeah. Oh, God, that would be awful.
Mm. Yeah.
That would be so dystopian.
I know.
You'd be like,
how did anything ever happen? Yeah. You know,
yeah. And also when they shot the UN scenes, it's actually at the UN.
Oh.
And Laura Bickford, the producer, had spent 18 months getting permission to shoot there, like had been sort of developing relationships and lining it up. And they were going to remodel the UN, so they only had, like, 2 weeks to kind of, like, get in there and shoot those scenes, but they hadn't even got the financing for that first film yet.
Wow.
So they just had to go and do it and hope that it fit together later on. Like,
oh, my God.
Yeah, that was before they'd even made Shay 2. The like, they hadn't even made Shay 2 then, so it was like they did Shay, anyway.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Is that why they did it in black and white? Just to...
No, I think that was a conscious choice. But, it was just sort of because it was sort of like archival footage or whatever.
Yes,
but,
yeah.
I have another one from Shay 1, part 1, where I really don't even understand because, like, he manages the budget as well, like, as a director. I just – it's such a complex artistry and practicality to make film that the final scene in what was the town called? Santa Clara. That whole, like, train derailing scene. Mm. It's actually a practical effect.
Wow.
Because he balked at the price of a CGI, how much it was going to cost to do it CGI.
Wow. So it was just like, let's just destroy a train.
Yeah. Mm. One take.
Wow.
That's it. Gosh. They had one chance. They blew up
that
train.
Amazing scene.
Fully.
That Santa Clara sequence is incredible.
Too.
We didn't really touch on that. But it is, as far I'm not a fan of war films and sort of warfare and that kind of thing, but I was, like, quite hooked on what was going on.
And that made me realise, like, because I've always just thought, oh, I don't like war films because it's about dudes being the worst dudes of all time. Like, war is the worst of men, essentially, in all aspects. But after watching that film, I was like, no, it's just because of the way I feel like I've seen war films romanticized but this was just like very dry and, or like glorified, you know, like Platoon or something like that. So, but this was just very normal and natural and pragmatic. I'm like, yeah, of course they're like shooting each other. It didn't, and it was fine. And it was like,
it always looks really
scary
messy.
And it was a bit scary and you're like, oh, no, and I was afraid for everyone. And, you know, I just wanted it to be over quickly so they could have a truce.
And nothing ever felt, like, super heroic or, like...
No.
No one ever... It was never like, oh, like, they clearly won because of, like, superhuman ability or anything. Like, everything looked messy. Everything looked random. Mm-hmm. Like, it all...
Chaotic,
yeah, which I think is more accurate.
Yeah.
I also loved... Lou Diamond Phillips as Mario Mohair, with his sweater wrapped around his shoulders, like going out to the like the filthy troops who've like been baking in their own sweat. Like, I just thought that was a hilarious contrast.
And he has not aged.
No, he's great.
Still beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you have any other bits of goss?
Not really. I didn't look anything up for these two. I shouldn't have admitted that, but sorry.
I've got something for the girlfriend experience.
Yeah, go for it.
Sasha Grey is half Greek.
What?
And I did not know that. Her real name is Marina Ann Hansis. So there you go. I'm adding it to my list of famous Greek people. I can't believe that I omitted that for so long.
So for the listeners at home that don't know us, which there are some, Maggie and Jessie are half Greek, half... white or Anglo, as we say here in Australia, and I'm half Maltese, half white. So we all have a running obsession of trying to find celebrities from our motherland.
I do have one from the motherland.
Do you?
Shay, part Irish.
What?
Get out of town.
Yeah, he had an Irish grandfather or great-grandfather.
Yeah, right.
Really?
And I can't remember the name, but it was like Leech or something like that. So, yeah. Yeah.
Tying things back to Australia, I couldn't think of anything Australian or Australian related for any of these films.
No, not well, I mean, yeah, the two laws, but not for the girlfriend experience. Oh, I actually, something I wanted to point out was that I think the girlfriend experience was actually the film, the first Soderbergh film that the three of us ever talked about.
Yeah.
And it was at the Melbourne Film Festival.
Yeah.
That's right, because we attended the same screening and I was going with my best friend and we were on the fence as to whether we wanted to go because I wanted to go because it was a Soderbergh film. But then when I found out Sacha Grey was in it and it was about an escort, I was like, oh, I don't think I want to go and see this. But we went and then we were all together and we were all just like thrilled at how amazing it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't think of anything that treats the material in the same, you know, in that non-pervy sort of, way. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Mostly it's anything I see about prostitutes and sex workers, it's like pervy.
And they die. You know,
Anyway, yeah.
All right. I think we'll wrap up this episode. All right. Thanks, ladies. And that concludes episode 10 of Club Soderbergh. So as you can imagine, we have 9 previous episodes for you to listen to. So catch up and hopefully we'll have you all caught up by the time we move on to the next films, which I can't remember what they are. I think
Informant.
Informant and Haywire.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. And as you can tell, they're chronological. So you can subscribe to us on Beyond Pod, TuneIn, iTunes, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks, as always, to Zeph Anastasiou, also another Greek in the house, our sound engineer extraordinaire and gracious host. But mostly, we love hearing from you guys. We love hearing how you feel about the films, your impressions, bits of gossip and information that you have that we may not have access to. You can contact us on email at club@clubsoderbergh.com or our Facebook and Twitter is the same, @clubsoderbergh. We'd love for you to be engaged with us, so send us a message. Otherwise, we'll see you in a month for more Club Soderbergh on the rocks.